Today is July the 28th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Google issues warning to Chrome browser users of a serious zero-day exploit. Google issued its third urgent upgrade warning in a month. Google has urged Chrome around the world to upgrade after it discovered a serious zero-day exploit. A new zero-day exploit, which is CVE-2021-30563, has been discovered in Chrome, and like the previous attack, it follows an anonymous tip-off. Unlike the majority of security flaws, a zero-day classification means the exploit has been made public before the company could patch it. Google confirmed it is aware of reports of an exploit for CVE-2021-30563 exists in the wild. Little is known about the exploit other than Google's categorization that it is a type confusion in V8, which is the open-source JavaScript engine at the heart of Chrome. To battle this new threat, all Chrome users should navigate to Settings, Help, About Google Chrome. If your browser version on Linux, macOS, and Windows is listed as 91.0.4472.164 or above, you are already safe. If not, manually check for updates, then restart the browser once the update is ready. Google has also confirmed that six other high-level threats are patched in this version of Chrome, as well as a single medium-level vulnerability. CVE-2021-30563 is the eighth zero-day vulnerability found in Chrome this year and the third in a month. Attacks on Chrome have been particularly prevalent in recent months, most notably from a group of hackers calling themselves Puzzle Maker. The group has been successful in chaining together Chrome zero-day bugs to install malware on Windows systems. Microsoft itself issued an urgent security warning for Windows users about this in June. A missing ampersand locked out some Chromebooks. Google says that it has fixed a major Chrome operating system bug that locked users out of their devices. Google's bulletin says that Chrome OS version 91.0.4472.165, which was briefly available, renders users unable to log into their devices, which essentially bricking them. Chrome OS automatically downloads updates and switches to the new version after a reboot, so users who reboot their devices are suddenly locked out of them. The go-to advice while this broken update is out there is not to reboot. The problem appears to boil down to a missing ampersand in Google's code. Specifically, it seems that Google uses one ampersand in a conditional statement in its crypto home, Vault Key Set, rather than two ampersand, which is the AND operator in C++, breaking up the line. The mishap prevented Chrome OS from checking user passwords against stored keys, and that left some users unable to log in. The latest stable update is stopping users from logging in. Google recommend that you do not update until further notice. A number of users also began reporting bugs around that time. Some complained that their devices wouldn't accept their passwords, while others say they couldn't even get past the boot up screen. Google had identified the issue with a new build, a new version 91.0.4472.165, 1.4.4.7.2.167 was being rolled out. Affected devices can log in via guest mode or an account that hasn't signed into the device. Once affected users have successfully signed in, they can follow the steps in Google Help Center to download the latest update. The whole selling point, however, of Chrome OS is that it's reliable and unbreakable, and botch updates like these hurt the operating system. It's not clear how such an obvious show-stopping problem like this made it into a stable release channel. Chrome OS has three testing channels that changes are supposed to go through: the canary, the development, and the beta channels, with weeks of testing between releases. However, this bug escaped that entire process. This problem also seems like something a unit test or automated testing could have caught. Not being able to log in is pretty obvious. The error marks a second defective Chrome operating system update pushed out this month. An update at the beginning of July made CPU usage spike on some models, slowing them down to a crawl. The business of subscription malware is getting bigger, more dangerous, and it's dirt cheap. A disturbing element of modern cybercrime is just how easy it is to procure powerful and invasive tools, the kind that can wreak total havoc on an unsuspecting victim's computer. New research shows a cheap, creepy malware circulating in the dark web that has the power to log your keystrokes and steal your data, all for a low, low price. Today, the malware economy resembles a subscription model, allowing developers to license their nefarious products to any paying dark web customer. In most cases, these customers don't even need to have much expertise, as most of the tool's features are automated. Researchers with security firm Checkpoint recently spotted just such a product circulating the web. It's a cheap, accessible program called XLoader, which can be used to hack into and steal information from both Windows and Mac OS devices. In a report published Wednesday, Checkpoint shows how XLoader is being sold for as low as $49 on a popular dark web forum. Criminals can license it from a developer to carry out attacks. Buyers only have access to the malware for a limited time, however, and must conduct attacks from a server controlled by the seller. For instance, it costs $99 for a 3-month subscription to XLoader, customized to infiltrate Mac OS devices. The Windows version, meanwhile, is more expensive, coming in at $129 for a 3-month subscription. The malware, which is an outgrowth of an earlier popular malware called Formbook, has been deployed in countries all over the world, with a majority of victims residing in the United States. Much like its predecessor, XLoader has all sorts of invasive potential, allowing an intruder to log your keystrokes, harvest login credentials, collect screenshots off your desktop, and also download and deploy other kinds of malicious files onto your desktop, and also download and deploy other kinds of malicious files onto the target device. Other features include network traffic sniffing and clipboard monitoring. XLoader's credential harvesting feature works for almost 100 applications, including browsers, messengers, FTP, and email clients. Most often, the malware is spread via a typical phishing scheme that used spoofed emails. Those emails come equipped with malware-loaded Microsoft Office documents, which, if downloaded, will inject the program into your computer. Government watchdog says minimum broadband speeds are too slow. Since 2015, the Federal Communications Commission has maintained that minimum broadband speed should stay the same, 25 megabits per second for downloading files and 3 megabits per second for uploading. That's a turtle crawl, or I'm sorry, that's a snail's crawl. Now a government watchdog is telling the FCC to reevaluate these rules in a new report, saying small businesses in 2021 require more bandwidth to effectively run their operations. The report produced by the Government Accounting Office, that's the GAO, also shows examples of small businesses around the country which aren't even getting the minimum speed required by the FCC. The FCC has faced heat over its broadband minimums. Earlier this year, a group of senators called for the agency to raise the bottom limit to 100 megabits for both download and upload speeds. The FCC has basically admitted that it has very little reliable data on whether people are getting the mandated minimum speeds or access at all. Its broadband coverage maps are based on self-reported data from the internet providers, who are, of course, incentivized to overstate their coverage to shirk regulation. It has attempted to create speed test apps to get more direct information and collected complaints directly from consumers. The picture is bleaker than the FCC has admitted, with many counties reporting less than 10% broadband availability at minimum speeds. But the GAO contends that there's enough evidence to reconsider these rules, and reports from small businesses show that many want a minimum of 100 megabits download speed and up to 1 gigabyte per second for offices and dozens of employees. Even Zoom recommends at least 3.8 megabits per second of upload speed to make high-definition video calls, which exceeds the federal minimum. Business owners also told the GAO that while they might be able to access broadband, it's expensive and unreliable. Others say they had to rely on expensive satellite internet services to have any reliable access to the internet. The GAO writes that raising this minimum benchmark to 100 megabits down and 10 megabits up would have long-term effects for people in rural communities who suffer most from these internet deserts. The change would lower the percentage of rural Americans who are considered to have acceptable broadband coverage from 83% to 67%. That's a strong argument that providers need to invest more in rural infrastructure. The failure of China's microchip giant. Xinhua Unigroup, a would-be or wannabe microchip champion, is facing bankruptcy. It is a setback in China's quest for semiconductor self-reliance. Xinhua Unigroup seems to be a play by China to lead in the critical microchip industry. Back in 2015, an obscure company run by a real estate mogul woke the world to China's ambition in semiconductors. With state funding and political backing, the company made a $23 billion bid to buy the American chipmaker Micron. 6 years on, China's would-be microchip champion looks more like a national disappointment. The company, Xinhua, Nuna Group said this month that one of its creditors had initiated bankruptcy proceedings, raising the prospect that it could be broken up. Xinhua's Unigroup's flagging financial fortunes are an uncomfortable failure for Chinese officials who sought to use state-guided funds and plans to pull even with the United States in competition over the future of technology. Once an exemplar of state-directed capitalism, Xinhua Unigroup is emerging as a cautionary tale about the waste that can come with misplaced investment and subsidies. Yet, to Chinese economic planners, it may not matter. Over the past 2 years, market incentives like the subsidies that bloated Unigroup's books have fed a boom to all things microchip. According to an analysis by state-run media, China created 58,000 semiconductor firms between January and October of 2020, roughly 200 a day. While many of these companies will fail, and the belief in Beijing is that a few may create breakthroughs. In other words, it's the technology, not the finances, that counts. Xinhua Unigroup has trained a new generation of semiconductor engineers and built a credible position in making memory chips. A better way to think of China's chip ambitions is in terms of its space program. Profit is not the point. Instead, the goal is to achieve self-sufficiency in manufacturing the tiny chips that make everything from automobiles to missiles and supercomputers work. The stakes are high. As the relationship between the United States and China has frayed, American microchip bans have dealt serious blows to Chinese companies like Huawei, the telecom infrastructure giant. The 2015 bid for Micron set off alarm bells in Washington, where the move was seen as a flagrant example of Chinese companies using state financing to buy sensitive technologies wholesale, backed by a state-run multi-billion dollar semiconductor fund. Tsinghua used a check-check. Unigroup seemed to be a play by China to buy its way into leadership in critical microchip industry. Tsinghua's Unigroup's bid for Micron, which failed, started a string of actions by U.S. regulators to tamp down China's ability to buy sensitive technology companies outright. It was an early stage of tech competition between the United States and China that eventually led to American blacklisting of Chinese companies over human rights and national security concerns. Tsinghua Unigroup said that this month that one of its creditors had initiated bankruptcy proceedings, raising the prospect that it could be broken up. More a semiconductor holding company than a known innovator, Tsinghua Unigroup spent billions to take over some of the country's most promising microchip firms, leading ultimately to one of China's largest smartphone chip design companies. Tsinghua Unigroup also reached high-profile agreements with some of the United States' best-known brands. In one deal, the Unigroup secured a $1.4 billion investment from Intel to develop smartphone chips. In another, Unigroup took over the controlling stake in HP's China-based server and storage business, H3C Technologies. It also took a stake in Western Digital, signed a strategic partnership with Dell, and joined an IBM chip licensing plan. To fund it all, Tsinghua Unigroup raised money from state funds allocated to help China catch up with foreign chip production abilities. Tsinghua Unigroup is a subsidiary of a company controlled by China's prestigious Tsinghua University, the alma mater of President Xi Jinping. Tsinghua Unigroup is more of a political success story than a technological success story. The geopolitical tensions that Tsinghua Unigroup helped trigger have ended up helping some of its businesses. Unisoc, the company's chip design division, has gained orders as Chinese firms have been barred from using American chip designers like Qualcomm. This year, officials publicly unveiled a 5-year plan that meticulously mapped out key governance initiatives. They charted ambitious goals for the tech industry and emphasized its importance for national security. The hope is that despite the waste, enough money will find its way to enough capable hands that magic will happen. Some of the money has already had an impact. Local firms have made leaps at designing microchips and foundries that make microchips. China's huge investment has barely made a dent in its reliance on foreign microchips. Even after tens of billions of dollars spent on the industry, China's domestic chip production met only 15.9% of chip demand in 2020, barely higher than its 15.1% share in 2014. Given government support, daring entrepreneurs, and a huge need to figure these technologies out, the prospects of success are not bad. The Biden administration blames China for a lack of Microsoft Exchange email service software that compromised tens of thousands of computers around the world earlier this year. The administration and allied nations also disclose a broad range of other cyber threats from Beijing, including ransomware attacks from government-affiliated hackers that have targeted companies with demands for millions of dollars. China's Ministry of State Security has been using criminal contract hackers who have engaged in cyber extortion schemes and theft for their own profit, according to a senior administration official. Meanwhile, the Justice Department on Monday announced charges against 4 Chinese nationals who prosecutors said were working with the Ministry of State Security in a hacking campaign that targeted dozens of computer systems, including companies, universities, and government entities. The announcements highlighted the ongoing cyber threat posed by Chinese government hackers, even as the administration has been consumed with trying to curb ransomware attacks from Russia-based syndicates that have targeted critical infrastructure, including a massive fuel pipeline. Even though the finger-pointing was not accompanied by any sanctions of Beijing, a senior administration official who disclosed the action to reporters said that the United States has confronted senior Chinese officials and that the White House regards the multinational public shamming as sending an important message. That hackers affiliated with the Ministry of State Security carried out a ransomware attack was surprising and concerning to the U.S. government, the senior administration official said. But the attack, to which an unidentified American company received a high-dollar ransom demand, also gave U.S. officials new insight into what the official said was the kind of aggressive behavior that we're seeing coming out of China. The European Union also blamed China for what it said was malicious cyber activities with significant effects that targeted government institutions and political organizations in the European Union and its 27 member states, as well as key European industries. In a statement, the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, said that the hacking was conducted from the territory of China for the purpose of intellectual property theft and espionage. The majority of the most damaging and high-profile recent ransomware attacks have involved Russian criminal gangs. Though the U.S. has sometimes seen connections between Russian intelligence agency and individual hackers, the use of criminal contract hackers by the Chinese government to conduct unsanctioned cyber operations globally is distinct. The Microsoft Exchange hack was first identified in January and was rapidly attributed to Chinese cyber spies by private sector groups. An administration official said the government's attribution, the hackers affiliated with China's Ministry of State Security, took until now in part because of discovery of the ransomware and for-profit hacking operations and because the administration wanted to pair the announcement with guidance for businesses about attacks that the Chinese have been using. An advisory from the FBI, the National Security Agency, and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency laid out specific techniques and ways that government agencies and businesses can protect themselves. The White House also wanted to line up an international coalition of allies to call out China, according to the official, who said it was the first time NATO had condemned Beijing's hacking operations. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson, asked about the Microsoft Exchange hack, had previously said that China firmly opposes and combats cyber attacks and cyber thefts in all forms, and cautioned that attribution of cyber attacks should be based on evidence and not groundless accusations. Google Cloud lost $5.61 billion in the calendar year of 2020. Hey, $5.61 billion is no chump change to lose. But compared to the gross profit for Alphabet Google of $97.8 billion, they have the financial strength to continue with Google Cloud to compete with anyone. Alphabet Google revenue for 2020 was $182 billion. That's a margin of profit greater than 50%. Alphabet Google is viewing the future technology growth in the transition to cloud computing by many firms. Many companies transitioning into cloud computing because it enables them to be agile and competitive in a fast-paced and ever-changing customer landscape. Cloud is a solution to reduce the expenses for maintaining on-premise workloads. It fosters constant improvements by scaling the operations on demand. It aids in streamlining and standardization of security measures. While the cloud computing industry is rapidly growing, there are still fans using on-premise IT infrastructure. They will have to keep up with companies who started or already did their cloud migration. If you're among cloud adopters, you will be having a competitive advantage over the other companies. A recent investigation showed that almost 80% of businesses feel they are serious competitors on the market. The opportunities of cloud technology are stunning. Google Cloud is number 3 in ranking behind number 1 Microsoft and number 2 Amazon. In calendar year 2020, Google Cloud, as I said, lost $5.61 billion on revenue of $13.1 billion, with the full year losses equaling 43% of revenue. So for Google Cloud, every dollar of 2020 revenue, Google Cloud lost 43 cents. But when Google Cloud's revenue growth performance is viewed in the proper context and with some perspective, the company's cloud growth is actually extremely impressive. Revenue is growing at hyperscale and has frequently risen, enabling Google to not only grab big chunks of market share, but also drive huge economies of scale. Alphabet's CFO has been extremely bullish on Google's cloud performance and on Alphabet's eagerness to continue to invest aggressively in the face of an enormous market opportunity. Alphabet CFO Ruth Porat said, "As for Google Cloud, our approach to building the business has not changed. We remain focused on revenue growth, and we will continue to invest aggressively in products and our go-to-market organization, given the opportunity we see. We do remain focused on continuing to invest to build the cloud organization for a long-term performance. We do intend to continue to invest meaningfully in cloud given the opportunity. So the main takeaway is we're continuing to invest. We'll invest aggressively in products and go to markets. At this point, we do remain focused on investing to build the organization for long-term performance." Let's just say Google with deep pockets is committed to be cloud computing services, and they will stay in it and they will succeed, no matter what the cost is. The Office of the U.S. Director of National Intelligence on June the 25th made public a highly anticipated report examining unidentified aerial phenomena, telling Congress that it could not draw firm conclusions on more than 140 instances. In a limited number of instances, unidentified aerial phenomena reportedly appeared to exhibit unusual flight characteristics. These observations could not be the result of sensor errors, spoofing, or observer misperception, and require additional rigorous analysis, as the report read. The report also concluded that a unique, tailored reporting process should be implemented to better be able to assess unidentified aerial phenomena, but found no evidence of extraterrestrial life. The report itself was short, filled with not really any information that we did not already know. The complete report, however, was not released to the public as Congress received the full report. Some of our questions about the existence of UFOs and extraterrestrial civilizations could be answered by a new international research project led by Harvard University to work on what is called the Galileo Project. The project was named for the famous astronomer Galileo. Galileo was in the period of time from 1564 to 1642. He was an Italian astronomer, physicist, and engineer. Galileo has been called the father of observational astronomy, the father of modern physics, the father of the scientific method, and the father of modern science. Galileo studied speed and velocity, gravity and freefall, the principle of relativity, inertia, projectile motion, and also worked in applying science and technology, describing the properties of pendulums and hydrostatic balances. He invented the thermoscope and various military compasses and used a telescope for scientific observation of celestial objects. His contributions to observational astronomy include telescopic confirmation of the phases of Venus, observation of the four largest satellites of Jupiter, Saturn's rings, and analysis of sunspots. Galileo, championing of Copernican heliocentrism, which is Earth rotating daily and revolving around the sun, was met with opposition from within the Catholic Church and from some astronomers. The matter was investigated by the Roman Inquisition in 1615, which concluded that the heliocentrism was foolish, absurd, and heretical since it contradicted Holy Scripture. Galileo later defended his views, which appeared to attack Pope Urban VIII and thus alienated both the Pope and the Jesuits, who had both supported Galileo until this point. He was tried by the Inquisition, found vehemently suspect of heresy and forced to recant. He spent the rest of his life under house arrest. The Galileo Project will be led by Harvard astronomy professor Avi Loeb, which will search for a record of alien civilizations capable of technology surpassing what we know on Earth. It will use telescope observations, missions that send cameras into space, and more. Given the recently discovered abundance of Earth-Sun systems, the Galileo Project is dedicated to the proposition that humans can no longer ignore the possible existence of extraterrestrial technological civilizations. The project comes on the heels of the government report on unidentified aerial phenomena and interstellar object called Oumuamua that enter our solar system in 2017 as reasons to search and confirm the existence of ETCs. Harvard researchers will do work on the mysterious interstellar object floating in space that might be alien. Loeb said that the idea for the project is that in the future, we will find more objects from interstellar space, and those that look peculiar, we should follow up by sending a camera on a space rocket that gets close to them and taking a close-up photograph. He added that the project will allow scientists to take a further look into the unidentified objects in space after the government report was released last month. Those military personnel and politicians that talk about these unidentified aerial phenomena were not trained by scientists. And it's sort of like asking the plumber to bake you a cake, Loeb said. We should not ask them to figure out what objects in the skies are all about. That's the job for scientists. The team, which includes professors from Princeton, Cambridge, and Stockholm universities, will study existing and future astronomical surveys along with artificial intelligence to identify interstellar objects that defy current scientific explanations. The data collected will be available to the public, and the team said the process will be transparent. Loeb noted that the project may not find groundbreaking evidence on interstellar objects, but he explained that the research will still help scientists understand other atmospheric phenomena. It's just like a fishing expedition, he said. You don't know what you will find, and I don't want to make any assumptions. But he still called the project one of the most fascinating questions that science can address. It will have huge implications on society, on humanity, Loeb said, if we find evidence for a smarter kid on our cosmic block. It will change the way we think about our place in the universe, our relations with each other. If we close the shutters on our window and say we don't have neighbors, we are the smartest, and give me extraordinary evidence before I will be willing to look through my window, then we will maintain our ignorance, just like in the days of Galileo. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Impact of chip shortages on information technology.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for us to get down to business. You may have heard about the chip shortage situation. It's still kind of a building situation. It's something that we don't really grasp fully in the industry. Why do I say this? Because a single plant serving specialized chips for cars made in Japan, just for Japan, was attributed to the start of this. And it seems that the dire warnings that followed turned into a self-serving prophecy. So I look at this as a manufactured situation, or at least a manipulated situation, where there may have been some supply chain hiccups, but the impact appears to be far more than what it should be. Even still, we, all of us, most of us, are at the bottom of all of this chain, and we have to deal with whatever is handed to us. So how do we deal with this? How do we deal with whether it's a real situation with chip shortages or something that's been manipulated? What do we do? So let's talk about this mostly from the IT aspect. For the personal aspect, you're going to have to make your own decisions. But a lot of people last year did make a lot of purchases in the computer field. As we moved into the back to school time period, when we had also a lot of the work from home and people had a lot of extra money because they weren't going on vacations and so forth. But now we move into the IT world. We move into the corporate world. And if you are in a smaller company, if you have control of your IT, I want you to right now be distinctly considering adding to your current inventory of all IT equipment and chip-enabled supplies for your needs at least through the next year and a half. What am I saying? Yes, through Christmas 2022. You need to start plotting it out. You need to actually be looking ahead. We have 100 employees that are on computers. We need to plot the refresh, and we need to be aggressive right now, at least in our purchasing, and we need to get the best of what we can because we need to make sure this lasts out the longest. And you need to hop on that. You need to do it quickly, especially if you're an IT gig worker. What am I talking about? Yes, if you're a contractor, especially like the 1099 contractors where you're supplying your own hardware, you're a hired gun developer or something like that. I want you to upgrade your hardware really soon as the numbers are going to shift. And it may be a while before you can get your high-grade hardware at a decent price. The only company that appears to not be shifting, oddly enough, is the company that's known to be the most expensive in the world of computing, of course, and that is Apple. Apple appears to be solid in their whole infrastructure of chip supplies and so forth, and part of that comes from they're making them in-house, and they're controlling the decisions with this new M1 processor. So they may be, at least to a certain level, insulated from a lot of the effects. Now, let's also look at the flip side. Apple is known for realizing that they've got strength and capitalizing upon that same strength. So we could even see Apple prices shifting up. And if Apple prices shift up, I guarantee you they're not shifting down. They're going to stay high. General employees, if you are on a computer, you're using any kind of technology, which is most of us, yes, you need to be prepared to wait an extra year or more in the replacement cycle. If your company usually issues you a brand new computer, whether it's a desktop, laptop, or whatever other technology, if they do it every 3 years, I would say 4 years. If they do it every 4 years, five. And if it's five, I'm going to say actually 6 or 7 years. They're going to stretch this out. Because if you're only getting replacements every 5 years, you're already behind the curve. Your employer doesn't understand the impact of those slow computers on your performance. So, yes, you're also going to have to expect that the work demands are going to continue. You're still going to be sitting there and you're still going to have to do the same amount of work, if not more. Lastly, let's talk about IT management. And this is something, this is the people who are driving IT at the higher levels. And these are the people who, when I say CapEx, you understand what's going on. We're talking about a readjustment to capital expenditures for those equipment outlays. But I'm also going to tell you that if you've got different projects that people are driving from upper management that are in IT, yeah, those IT projects, there's going to be delays there. There's going to be delays across all the IT projects with ripple effects that are going to last throughout and be cast throughout the rest of the entire sector of your business. All of this, it's going to affect you guys. Your profit and loss statements are going to be affected. Everything is going to be going a little bit crazy. And this is coming at a bad time when people are realizing just how important the IT department actually is and how much they need to put into the information technology of the business to maintain that competitive advantage against your competitors. Yeah. This is all going to turn out to be very interesting. I wish I had something more of a crystal ball, but I don't. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Cutting the cord on traditional cable or satellite TV. By the way, you don't really cut the cord because you still need it for the internet service. When they say cutting the cord, they mean the television program. It can be an easy way to trim costs, and there are many people making this break. Satellite TV services lost about 750,000 subscribers in the third quarter of 2020. The top seven cable companies lost about 375,000 video subscribers in last year's third quarter. Older people are more likely to stick with their traditional provider, as in the case of those who aren't technically savvy or who are, well, adverse to change. But for those who are inclined, it could be worth investigating your options, especially if you're trying to save a few bucks and aren't using existing services fully. While the opportunity to potentially save hundreds of dollars a year may seem like a no-brainer, there are multiple things to consider. The service or services you choose can turn on factors such as your viewing habits, your budget, and your desire or ability to manage a la carte services. In some instances, cutting the cord can be more costly than traditional operators, depending on the packages you choose. Television viewing options today can be divided into various categories. There is traditional satellite, cable, and telephone providers. These providers, which have been around for decades, include Comcast, DirecTV, Spectrum, and Verizon Fios. They allow you to watch live, local, national, and a variety of premium channels. You can watch and often record broadcast and cable networks using an interface and remote you're familiar with. You can bundle television viewing services with the internet and phone service for easier billing and discounts, potentially negating some of the cost benefit of switching. The downside is monthly costs can be high. You may also be tied to a multi-year contract for a multitude of channels you don't watch. Another downside is that the advertised rates may be much less than the actual cost of service after equipment, channel, and other fees and taxes are included. Alternatively, there is internet-delivered live TV services. These services, which include Hulu Plus Live TV, Sling TV, AT&T TV, and Fubo TV, allow users to stream live television and on-demand content. You may be able to view many of your favorite programs and channels for less money than a traditional live TV provider. Prices vary depending on the package and provider, but costs can range from $20 a month to $80 a month before taxes. The downside is you got to do some research on each of the providers to see whether or not they carry your most loved channels. An avid sports fan in particular may find the available options less than ideal. Most internet-delivered live pay TV services offer a way to watch at least certain games. But if you're counting on being able to view specific sports and teams and you're adamant about catching all or most of the games, carefully check each provider's offerings so you won't be disappointed. For DVR junkies, the capability can vary by provider and the package you choose. Then there is subscription video on demand providers. These include Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime. Consumers can choose which subscription service or services they want and change their mind monthly if desired. These services can bring significant cost savings for consumers who aren't interested in live television, and they also offer flexibility to consumers who want to craft their own packages. An ad-supported monthly plan on Hulu, for instance, before taxes is $5.99 a month. Netflix, meanwhile, will cost you $13.99 a month for the standard plan that provides access to high definition and two screens at a time. Depending on how many a la carte services you choose, the cost can add up. Canceling requires action before the next billing cycle. Another consideration, you'll need to take additional steps if you want live TV. One option is to subscribe to an internet-delivered live TV service along with however many video on-demand providers you choose. Just be careful. Going this route could diminish the cost savings you hope to achieve by dumping your traditional provider. A less expensive option would be to use an antenna for viewing over-the-air television broadcast channels such as ABC, NBC, and CBS. But it won't allow access to national news stations such as CNN or MSNBC. There can also be reception issues, depending on where you live, with more limits in rural areas. You might also consider an app, such as Locast, a not-for-profit service that offers users in certain locations access to broadcast television stations over the Internet. Be sure to check if it's available in your area and whether it's compatible with your devices and platforms. The service is free, but a small monthly donation is requested. What equipment would I need to dump my traditional provider? To access internet-delivered live TV services or video-on-demand services on a TV, which most people do, you'll need one with an HDMI connection, which shouldn't be a concern if you purchased a television set in the past decade or so. You don't necessarily need a so-called smart TV with multiple built-in apps because there are streaming devices such as the Roku streaming stick, the Amazon Fire Stick, and Chromecast that can be attached to a regular television and accomplish the same thing. These services can also be accessed via a computer, tablet, or smartphone. You'll also need a high-speed internet connection, and be sure to ask your internet provider about data caps. If you're just streaming video, the data caps probably aren't going to be an issue. The bottom line is, how much money can you save? Well, that depends on what services you choose. If you're paying more than $100 a month with traditional provider and aren't watching live TV, signing up with an on-demand provider will be huge savings. But if you maintain multiple monthly-based subscriptions, cost savings can be diminished, especially if you also sign up with an internet-delivered live TV service provider. Although it is referred to as cutting the cord, there is a cord that is necessarily basic to all this, and that is the connection to the internet. You gotta pay for it in one way or the other. Researchers develop an ARM microprocessor built out of plastic. Researchers with ARM and Pragmatic IC have developed the first true microprocessor that employs plastic, not silicon, as its base material. The 32-bit plastic ARM microprocessor concept features around 18,000 logic gates, a processor, memory, controller, and inputs and outputs. The development, published in Nature, will allow a new era of truly bendable, flexible microchips that are also cheaper to produce than silicon. Silicon has been the base element for semiconductor manufacturing since the dawn of computing, which began over 50 years ago with the introduction of the Intel 4004 CPU. That packed an, at the time, astonishing 2,300 transistors. The use of silicon is predicated on two fundamental characteristics. First, it's the second most common element on Earth, which means it's both cheap and readily available. Second is a capability to function as either an energy conductor or an energy insulator, depending on its implementation. However, silicon does have some drawbacks that are becoming more and more limiting in regard to the scope of its applications. For one, it's brittle and rigid. The second important point is that while it may be cheap to produce, it's certainly not cheap enough to be used in everyday, expendable products in a cost-effective way. The plastic ARM development, using plastic as a medium with which processing chips can be built, overcomes both these limitations. This, however, is not a replacement for silicon. The researchers point out that silicon presents advantages in terms of performance, density, and power efficiency. Instead, the two technologies are expected to complement each other according to the application requirements. The researchers point out possible applications in bottles. For smart milk or juice bottles that analyze whether or not the product has gone rancid. Food packages, garments. Imagine a sweater that smartly detects odor or outside temperature and increases the space between fiber for better cooling. Wearable patches, bandages, and so on. Other possible applications include biomonitors. Imagine a thin plastic, computing-capable film that's placed on internal organs or tissue for diagnostic and early signs of trouble. Wearable electronics patches that can display information directly on your skin, another option, or less invasive diagnostics for wildlife monitoring. Researchers predict scaling capabilities of up to 100,000 logic gates before power consumption becomes a problem and additional materials are required for the manufacturing process. Even so, the test chip only consumes around 21 milliwatts of power, most of it wasted in idle states, which could easily be provided solar cells smaller than postage stamps. Eventual charging mechanisms will look towards wireless charging technologies, enabling true self-contained chips. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Westchester PC User Group meets Thursday, August the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 12th at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 13th at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is limac.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group, Thursday, August the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.